Does anyone have anything to share or ask?
That helps me a lot, because I want to talk about something that sometimes people would call an assumption, sometimes a habit energy, but I don't know what the real word could be for what that is. That when you're saying it's not just the mind in terms of thinking mind, there's in the psyche so much else that moves us and blocks us and maybe in the Indian spirituality, that sanskar, that the formation, the shape of the psyche that then could normally determine where the energy is going to flow, unless we let that shape get reshaped somehow. Yeah, please. A good reason. And now do you feel connected to trees?
But it's not just like a
no. So what else is it?
The retreats for sure. Mm-hmm. So I'm a big advocate of both.
Yeah. I think it is true for many of us to need to have that help to stay with not just the difficult, but the areas of intensity, the powerful areas in the psyche. And maybe that's one difference here, is that I'm trying to feel for the gravitation towards not the difficult, not the painful, because that it does so easily keep us stuck to it without that help to be with it in a way that allows it to reshape. So that, because we have such a tendency to stick to the wounds, then yes, and that 20%, 10%, 80%, 90%. Someone brought me the word dialogue today, which could be another word for non-separateness, where there is, so non-separateness doesn't mean all one. So dialogue among the different parts, that because of not being separate, isolated, there can be a dialogue, which is not just words. There's one example of a dialogue in words that goes beyond words is given by David Bohm, who was a scientist, but he was interested in people. He was a physicist, but he was interested in people. And he describes a dialogue in a culture that's maybe more natural than what we're used to now. And people would come together, all ages were welcome, and everybody could speak. Anybody could speak, and everybody was listened to. And no decision was made. There was not the action plan, and you're gonna do that, and you're gonna do that, and then we'll meet back in 3 days then we'll check how you did. And there was no decision made. But he said people got up from that gathering and did what they did. They did what needed to be done. So children spoke. So maybe some people, they might take some voices more seriously. But everybody could speak and be listened to, and then. So having the help to be able to hear the parts that haven't been listened to in a long time, inside, the dialogue inside. Joanna Macy, who is like sunshine, and she loves trees also. She studied Buddhism as well as life and people. And she was interested in looking at life in terms of closed system and open system, and that living things are open systems. And she said that an open system can get more and more and more articulated, diverse, each part having its autonomy more and more, as long as the communication among all of that gets more and more and more. And at first, when I read that, I thought, oh my God, that sounds awful. Like the endless meetings, you know, that would be terrible. But feeling that kind of dialogue where the speaking just comes up and the listening happens and then the doing happens without a decision, plan, compulsion, commitment. Maybe the commitment is to listening and curiously enough, an example of what I'm hoping to get at here in how dialogue is not just what's said, but in the fact that someone came with this, but you're talking about silence and not thinking and not separateness, but I need dialogue and I love dialogue. And it's like, yeah, that's a good word for not separateness. But meanwhile, already Jacques Lucéran, who I mentioned yesterday, I think, the blind boy, right? So when he was a young teenager, he was in the French resistance movement during World War II. And France had been already taken over. And he was living there. He was not 18, so he wasn't taken to work. He was 16. And so he and his friends, who were not yet 18, found what are the ways, what are we going to do here? And he said, none of us had the illusion of being important, but all of us were sure of being necessary. So that kind of feeling of that kind of participation, that just that feeling, so that acknowledgement inside, no illusion of being important and very sure of being necessary. That brings us, that includes us in a dialogue that isn't only about what we speak together. And so curiously, that what I came to for Jacques for the teachings today, before the subject of dialogue came up in words with someone in a dialogue, Jacques had brought his experience of dialogue, non-separateness, communication among diverse, unique parts of an open system. Open system within open system. His role, because he was blind, he became the one who would filter. He would, let's say, interview who's going to join, who's going to be able to be part of this secret movement. So one of the most important jobs that someone could have. Anyone who wanted to join would have to meet Jacques in the way that Jacques wanted to be met. So a very particular system of being allowed in through the two doors, past the bells, into the room. He was 16, and so people of all different ages that hadn't gotten taken away, maybe they were older, maybe they were younger, would come. They didn't know anything about him except they could kind of guess that he was blind because they would walk into the room and he would usually forget to turn the light on. And then they could see through the door to all his Braille books. So Braille is that kind of writing that you feel with your finger. Braille. Braille is probably a French word. Do you know that?
I can't remember.
But you know what I mean?
Yes. Okay.
So first, it can be interesting as one possible way of listening better to different parts inside, outside. He said that he didn't really have a system, and the idea of adopting a system never occurred to me, he says. But what he would do for the first 10 minutes was not really give them anything to go on. He would just let them kind of feel uncomfortable and see what they did. That could be what psychoanalysts do, maybe. So, for the first 10 minutes at least, there must be no settled topic of conversation. Above all, that in itself might well be a method. So sometimes people, we wonder, what am I doing here and what is meditation and how do I get it or get into it? And that can be a nice way. It's just make sure that you don't settle on a topic for 10 minutes or so and feel a bit uncomfortable, and then what? And what? So most of the people felt disconcerted, like surprised and uncomfortable, basically, disoriented. And because they felt disoriented and uneasy, they tried by every means possible to get over it. They stammered out complicated explanations. And nothing is more revealing of any individual as every psychologist knows well, than elaborate explanations. But in the end, every one of these tactics, so every one of these sort of techniques of trying to find out what is this person, the tactics amounted to very little. How's it going?
What's elaborate?
Elaborate, like very complex and with a lot of effort, maybe. So then he says, if I could plumb these hearts and consciences, if he could find the bottom, get to the bottom of these people, their heart and their psyche and their conscience has also the feeling of whether they're sincere or not, whether they want to help or not. And he says he felt sure he could do that. He could really get the person. He said that if I could do it, it was because I was blind and for no other reason. So what does that mean? It's really simple and really deep. And it's both the literal and the metaphoric. When we meet someone with our eyes open, we can experience right now what happens. We're relating to what we see, first of all, rather than any other part of us. And Jacques describes how, having lost his vision, he started to find this deeper way of meeting life. And he noticed that because vision works so, so well, that from a distance we can see so much, that then we get kind of lazy and fast, and we take a few details and run with it. And this is sometimes where we can catch our assumptions, which could be a literal assume. So I try to think of an example not on retreat so we don't start getting paranoid about what the others are thinking here. I guess one fun one for me, because for so many decades of my life, I didn't own a car. And when I would visit the United States, where you are your car, I would always be in a borrowed car. And so people would always think I was someone other than I am. So we see a little and we don't watch how we're assuming. We're making a picture that isn't based on anything, based on enough. And we could hear that and get, yeah, yeah, that's true, yeah, yeah, yeah. And again, run too fast past that. And the one mistake that Jacques made much later on was because of being in a hurry. The movement had gotten so big, and they had a whole new area that they needed a head person for that. And he was too quick, too rushed. The person who came managed to trick him into being too rushed. And that was the betrayal. So he'd had lots of years of practice already, so he'd had about 8 years of practicing feeling and meeting life in this way, meeting people. In a way, you could say, knowing that he's not important, but he is necessary. He's fully in the dialogue. When I was very young, I had acquired the habit of guessing since I could no longer see. So just, again, it sounds so simple and let's get on with it. But if we could, even though we can see, start to just question and investigate if our guessing is more accurate than our seeing. And then we can let our eyes work differently. It would so help. We think that seeing is more accurate and more sophisticated, and as if guessing would be going backwards, being more primitive, and we assume primitive is less skillful. So he would read signs instead of gestures and put them together to build a coherent world, What is more, I admit I was madly happy to be doing this work. To have people in front of me, to make them speak not about themselves, to induce them to say things. This mosquito is trying to get inside my mouth. So he would find ways of making people uncomfortable enough that they would speak not about themselves, to say things they were not in the habit of saying, because these things were set so deep inside them. So it's curious that the subject of psychoanalysis has come. So he would suddenly, he's mostly listening for this, suddenly he would get them off track so he could really hear the whole person, he could get the whole psyche laid in front of him. And then suddenly to hear in their voices the note above all others, the note of confidence. When I read that, I was not expecting that to be the word he was looking for. The note of confidence. So not just honesty and sincerity and strength and patience and courage, but confidence. I think the confidence, as well as the love of doing that, being in that kind of dialogue, and I think they go together. The love of being in that dialogue and the confidence that can come by being in that dialogue. Seems to allow a different kind of energy to work, a higher dialogue to happen. The way Jacques experienced it is like this, he said. When he would hear that note of confidence in the voice of someone who was otherwise feeling really disoriented, and they're talking about the war and France. So a note of confidence in that situation. When he heard it, he said, this filled me with an assurance which was very like love. Around me, it drew a magic circle of protection, a sign that nothing could happen to me. So he heard confidence in someone else's voice. He felt some kind of, we could say quietness, or we could say even more confidence. It felt like a magic circle of protection. The light which shone in my head was so bright and so strong that it was like joy distilled. Then too, I became infallible, or nearly. So because he was confident, because he would find ways of meeting people fully, and because that felt so good, then he got better and better at meeting people and hearing them and what they're up to. And then he starts to talk about the group of its guys that they're working together. As each day went by, some of us had to get used to some strange phenomena. Some strange things happening. Since we had been in the resistance, our mental powers had grown stronger. Our memories were unbelievably agile. So this can happen when there's listening, that part of you wants to stop and interrupt the flow and say something or write it down, but when we really get into the flow and have confidence, we confide in the flow. And we love being in the flow. And then that refines our sensitivity. We can hear more, we can feel better. There's more accuracy. Content and timing. Our memories were unbelievably agile, so they could bend and jump. Quick. We read between the words and the silences. Deeds, which is just acts, actions, which only 2 months before seemed impossible to us, putting walls or phantoms in our path, were now broken down into the into a dust of easy little tasks. So things that had seemed impossible, they seemed to be a block 2 months before. By being in that dialogue ongoing and really caring and not getting involved in being important, but feeling they're being necessary, their part in the dialogue being necessary. The blocks, the assumptions, fell apart. And they talked about it, they called it a state of grace. And he said, as far as I was concerned, I was aware that my conscience was in touch with the conscience of hundreds of others, growing in rhythm with their sufferings or their hopes. So on retreats, I notice something that I don't know what it is. So sometimes I can just get away with saying, oh, the energy of the retreat. And people will go, oh yeah, the energy of the retreat. But I don't know what it is. And I'm starting to really want to know what other people's experience of that is. I haven't seen much, or actually I haven't seen anything. It could be that it's out there. But now Jacques has helped me. So the energy of the retreat. Each retreat seems to have its own kind of shape and shape of power, direction, flavor. And it does just seem to be by getting into sync, being here together. And maybe the more each person feels really free, that you really, really can be yourself. And that being yourself, you do care about your own practice and the other's practice. And that the more each one goes into one's own practice, as best we can, our best guess, the more that feeds an energy of the retreat. And then it's hard for you to know in silence, but people will come in interviews or write notes, or Jacques or whoever will come. People will come on the last retreat in a row, dun, dun. I had a dream last night about da-da-da. Different story, same subject. So similar shape in the psyche, such different language and context, and the beauty of the two things. That there's some way that we're in sync and still allowed for that to be freely your own. And so just noticing the energy of the retreat. Not knowing what it is or how it works or if anyone else can talk to me about it. But really starting to notice that it is a happening. It's one level of our dialogue. And it feels a little bit like the story of people who are living in the Americas. And here comes Christopher Columbus in this big boat thing, which the people living in the Americas had not seen that big boat thing. They lived by the water, and so they were in touch with the water, but they'd never seen that kind of big boat ship. The ships were made with 200 oak trees to make the masts, and however many sort of hectares of linen for the sail. And so what I've been told, maybe it's true, is the people that lived on that island who knew the water but didn't know ships, they saw something funny happening in the water. The pattern of the water was different. So they were seeing the wake of the ship, but they could not see the ship that was making the wake. The ship was visible to their eyes, but they couldn't see the ship. They could see the wake. And looking at the wake and looking at, what is that? What is that? That's how I feel, looking at awake. When the ship goes through the water and the way the water turns to the side in a V.
Jenny, are you saying they saw the ship, but they had no idea what it is? Or they
couldn't see anything there.
There was no perception of the ship.
Yeah, the brain didn't do it. So the light would have been going through the mechanical situation.
No concept of it at all.
Yeah. Apparently. So there would have been an assumption that doesn't exist, and therefore that experience doesn't happen. Such a deep assumption that what I've experienced so far doesn't leave room for that. So that isn't. One thing I like about this example also is that it's not like someone's fault. It's not like the people who lived on that island, if only they had been more something, they could have seen the ship and done something to the ship so that they could still have their island today. So the word assumption I don't like because it sounds like something under our control, and that's why it's great that Jayaji was talking about the psyche and how much of it is not really under our control, but we can start to, with help, get there and feel it, get to know it, and it. Getting to know what are the raw ingredients here. Does anyone want to ask or say anything?
How do we know the difference between in ourselves assumptions and then like intuition?
Yeah. Mostly, it's a really good question that by experience we start to refine the intuition and get better at feeling what it feels like to live by an assumption, to stick to an assumption. And again, it's not like we decide to stick to the assumption. And we need to find out, and we can find out, why is that stickiness happening? We talked about stickiness last week. Why is that sticking to the assumption happening? What's the, it's not motivation, but like what the impulse or energy that goes towards sticking to an assumption. What is that? And I think that one way to play with, to make some experiments with, is basically what we'd be interested in, I think, is I try to find my intuition. Is there some assumption mixed in here? That seems like that would be a fruitful way. A lot of times, for a lot of people, the intuition is mostly unavailable when we're sort of covered with fear. Whereas an assumption would be sort of part of the fear. It would kind of grow with the fear. Maybe. And as the intuition gets more, as we trust that dialogue, that can come through as intuition. So that can come through in some kind of felt guess. That then starts to get enough alignment with our thinking that we can kind of hear in thinking, stop or go or whatever, relax or. Run, whatever. So that, again, that beautiful mind, the way it can start to come into full alignment with practicing with intuition, with something deeper than intuition. And then we might have a word in the mind that we didn't even feel first. Is that my intuition? It's just, or the body just does something without my permission, but it didn't need my permission. It was so aligned, it jumped. So what I find is with that wish, sincerely making best guesses of intuition, it tends to get lighter and lighter. The touch of the intuition, lighter and lighter. Less and less me. And more willing to go against my preference, my programming. Whereas assumption is programming. What do you think? Yes.
And that's enough?
Yeah.
But it needs the space to do it.
Mm-hmm. Great. Anyone else? Yeah.
And while we were talking, I was trying to see if I could see a difference between the guesses that turned out to be true and the guesses that turned out to be false.
Mm.
So there's like a partial answer, and it's a little bit too easy, and I'm not sure it's totally correct, but it seems like many times the faults were like where the actually belong to my perception of myself, so maybe I thought that I'm more important to the other person than I actually am, and somehow it distorted the way I see them. Like, I wasn't even thinking that I was thinking about myself, but somehow it got in the way. But again, it's too easy, because one time actually I had an intuition that was, I knew it was related to myself, like I felt somebody was similar to me in some way. But then I also knew that it might either be right or be completely wrong, and it turned out to be right. So, I don't know.
It could be random, or there could be something. So even randomly we'll get it right sometime. But maybe... there's, if like that, leaving room for what we can't feel yet, or we don't think we can feel yet, and maybe there's something, maybe there's some communication that you didn't realize. So again, that the beautiful mind thing, where I've noticed that, how's it going? Yeah? Okay. It can come into the mind a certain kind of thought that it almost feels like a wave going backwards, so kind of like a revealing thought.
Mm.
That's the words would be something like, oh, I wish, or oh, I hope that, whatever. The retreat will be transformative in a certain flavor. And what I've noticed is that thought is inaccurate in one way. The wish and the hope part is inaccurate. Because what the thought is a realization of what's starting to happen. And the hooking onto the wish or hope could easily take me out of the dialogue of this happening. Does that make sense? You can play with it. If you do the singing practice, you could play with it in the singing practice. Like, I hope the singing will be good. I hope I'll get into the singing and melt, or whatever, that I will be less embarrassed or something. And then, if I tune out of hope and into the singing melting, it starts to be part of singing melting. So, but that would be an intentional exercise. And this is when something comes to mind that we wish or we hope, but it's actually the very beginning of it happening in our experience. It's beginning to be able to be felt in the psyche. And the hope, wish part can... Yeah. Does anyone have an example for me? I don't have any other example.
I mean, are you almost saying that the very instance that you have a hope or a wish for something, the moment that you bring it into your perception, it's already there? Like, it's already kind of, it's on its way to creation?
Not quite. Because I'm speaking when it's not intentional. Mm-hmm. It's not me bringing something up that I want. That comes from a different place. It's a thought that comes up, and that there's a feeling of, oh, it would be so nice if, could be so many different, could be it rains. Or for me, it's more about the retreat. It would be so nice if the retreat, and then a certain flavor comes. So it's not my intention looking for, I hope the retreat is like last time. That I don't wish that. But it comes, oh, it would be nice if the retreat has that particular flavor. So wide and deep. And then I've noticed, retreat after retreat and day after day, that that thought first came when it was starting to become able to be felt in the hall, that quality. And so the wish or hope, it was extra. It was just like a beginning taste, like if you would smell the food before eating, or you're, it's more like you're eating the food, but. That's a good question. Similar kinds of things can happen with all kinds of events, yeah. And the mind, the language might flip the meaning. It might be that, oh good, it's not gonna rain. And somewhere it could be just my animal body knows, feels that it's about to rain. But the mind says, oh, but it won't rain. The subject rain is that beautiful mind operating, being in alignment with the animal body that feels rain coming. But then it gets filtered as, I hope it doesn't rain, or I hope it rains. So it can be, yeah, anything. And that's my experience. Gautam Buddha, one of his sort of one-line teachings, he's sometimes asked for a, give it to me all in one sentence. And sometimes it's hard to crack and get into the juice of it. But so one of them is, nothing is worth adhering to. Adhering is, it's a great word, it's a good translation, I don't know what the original word is, but. Nothing is worth adhering to. So nothing is worth, we could say sticking to. Nothing is worth sticking to. But adhering in English also has that meaning of like, I adhere to the Buddhist religion, which I don't, but, or I adhere to the philosophy of whatever. So it's good. Nothing is worth adhering to. And then Gautam describes what happens having heard that line. So this is the deep participation listening dialogue, where the words came up out of the dialogue, out of the whole, and the hearing happened as part of that whole. No one so important, everyone necessary. The words came up, the listening happened. Having listened, they said, having heard that, one directly knows one's experience. And this is what we're basically doing all the time in the little moments. We notice that there's adhering to maybe an expectation that my meditation should go a certain way, maybe pressure to try to make it go that way. There's some kind of sticking, which we could feel as block or pressure. It could feel stuck or it could feel pushy. And then just nothing is worth adhering to. So those moments when we feel, oh, I put so much pressure on myself, and puh. Whatever way, it's going to naturally happen at some point. Non-adhering. So maybe giving up. Ugh. And then we're in touch with direct experience. And he goes on that we're in touch with direct experience, and one important aspect of the direct experience is its slipperiness, the fact that it's here and gone, its immediacy. Is there any other question before I go on, or anything to share?
If someone asked you for teaching, like, and only had, you know, 20 words, what would you say?
A tweet. Well, I think the beautiful thing is that it's not so much about having, that's the trouble with receiving the teachings this way, like written in a book that everyone, you can just open anytime. I mean, the timing of opening it is part of a dialogue, but it would be like, you're asking me, but you had that feeling coming, or suddenly you asked, but not like, oh, sort of hypothetically, what would you say, Jaya, for the news camera or something. It's not a living, necessarily. The way you ask the question is not like you're asking me a question coming out of the dialogue. So I can give you some news. The words would fit the context, the contours, the... So maybe it's may come across as too childish, but I'd like to just play a game really quick before I read a little bit more of Jacques about two kinds of hope. So just ignore me if you feel insulted by this. But the importance of getting to know what are our raw ingredients that we're working with. And how fun that can be, how much we don't know. And by not knowing, we may be unable to have that communication, that dialogue with that part. So it's just a matter of, I'm gonna say a word, and you're gonna, if you want to, feel, notice in your mind what happens when you hear the word, that's all. And then you notice what happens, and then I'll say another word, maybe three words. It's not gonna be too excruciating. So, ready? Mm-hmm. Rhinoceros. 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 Sorry. What's rhinoceros? Okay. cloud. Can I do four words? Bump. Surprise. So what happened in your head or your experience, your body? Did anyone see a picture, for example, of a rhinoceros?
Yeah.
So a few people. Did anyone see the word written in your head?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Not all the words.
Mm-hmm. Which ones?
Surprise.
Did anyone hear the word, for example?
No, probably bump, I sort of got knocked.
What happened with cloud?
I stand on the bone of the room.
Feeling. Mm-hmm. Calm? Color. Mm-hmm. So one thing that to notice for yourself could be surprise is the more abstract word. And so to just to feel how that was different in your head, or maybe not your head, but your body. In your experience, your psyche.
Diet. For me, the word bump was a surprise.
Mm-hmm.
So when you said bump, I felt surprised.
Yeah.
And then I imagined driving in India.
Mm-hmm.
And lots of bumps. Yeah.
Right.
And then you said the word surprise, so I immediately related that back to how I felt when you said bump.
Yeah.
So I was feeling surprised. Like it continued
from bump to surprise. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was very effective. I had the experience kind of like when you play the game or somebody says a word and then you think of like a word association.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, all of the associated words were desires.
Mm-hmm.
So I just found it interesting when you said bump. Baby,
mm.
Which is weird to me. A couple of other things, you know,
mm-hmm.
just immediately thought of like another word that
mm-hmm.
I would associate it with.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Cool. So when it's somebody else's mind, it's so interesting, isn't it? So you can let it be interesting. There's maybe one small detail in the story of Jacques and how their group was working to really give us more and more of that permission to be ourselves, and that we can still, so around separateness and non-separateness, that we really can be whatever this is. It can be, the mind can be as it is. That's raw ingredients that we can grow. It doesn't need to first be like Gotam's mind or someone's mind. So he says, for example, Georges was a nationalist, I mean a patriot and a jingo, to the point where if he wanted to sing the Marseillaise, he could never get to the end of it. It made him weep like a little girl. No, little girl, like little child, let's say. How we teased him. So someone is working towards peace, but actually has this less than peaceful vibe in it, but it still is part of the movement. Did you understand the English? Yeah. And he describes how each one was different. And then he talks about what they're doing and why they're doing it. And the main thing that they're doing, he says, it was urgent. So what was urgent? What's urgent? It was urgent to guide public opinion and set it straight. Never forget that in those days, in the middle of 1941, most of our compatriots, so most of the other people in France, and almost the whole of Europe had lost hope. The defeat of the Nazis seemed improbable at the least, or postponed to an indefinite future. It was our duty to declare, It was our duty to declare, to cry out our faith in the victory of the Allies. News was needed, surely, but courage even more, and clarity. So I find it relevant to us today, this factor of public opinion, and the fact that public opinion can be guided. But we'll leave that there. I think it's monstrously important. But here he's using the word hope in a very wholesome kind of way. Hope in the sense of breaking down the assumption about how it's going to be. There was the assumption about how it's going to be. It's going to be Nazi. And so hope in that case is breaking an assumption. The other kind of hope that goes with fear and works to keep the assumptions tightening their grip on us, or our grip on them, whatever it may be. We assume that meditation is supposed to go a certain way. We assume that my experience of it is not that way. And something gets tighter and closed down and more stuck. And so in that case, a helpful hope would just be to break the idea that we know what meditation is, or that we're sure of how my experience is going according to that or not. Whereas hope that I'll get it right is further buying into the assumption, getting squeezed more. Is that clear? Enough example. The hope that I'll get it right is the fear that I won't. Whereas hope in the sense of giving up, we could say giving up hope and giving up fear. Who knows what meditation is? And who's to say, just based on my conscious experience in this last hour, whether I was on track or not? On track or not. Sometimes we feel so agitated the whole time until maybe 1 minute before the bell or something, because we gave up, I mean, maybe. And we assume that that's wrong. And somebody's fault, mine, yours, somebody's. That's so common. So commonly we will say, I had a bad meditation. Or whatever, I have a bad personality, bad mind, bad anger, bad something. Can we feel how equally squeezed we are by having a good whatever? I had a good meditation, we're hopeful. Still based on the same assumption that I know what meditation is, and I'm a good judge of my experience right now, how it's going, where it's going, and that I should be judging it. All of that unquestioned. it's going well. If we can feel, that is so helpful. If I can feel when I think I'm hopeful, and I'm not going to turn around and question the fear that's driving me. I'm just not going to feel that pressure that's pushing me until the pressure is going to stall out whatever flow was going on. How does that sound? Two kinds of hope. So kind of a bit more like a big hope of just crashing the assumptions.
Mm-hmm. That second hope you just described creates a separation.
Mm-hmm. Can you say that a little louder? You don't have to sit up. You can just say it louder.
The second kind of hope creates a separation because it's coming from the assumption.
Which means? It's coming from assumption, which the assumption is coming because of fear, which means it's not coming from direct experience. It's not coming from connection. We can, in a second, connect with the experience of fear and assumption, and we're fine. We're back. We get information. The dialogue is back on. It's never a problem that can't be, okay. So it's not like, oh no, another assumption, I'm such a failure, all is lost. Yeah.
The experience of people and friends at the time, the direct experience was that Nazis are all around.
For some reason, I couldn't hear the most important words. No. The assumption that this is going to go on forever. The direct experience is this is like this now. The assumption is this. There's nothing to do. There's no response. So they felt, partly they had a really good teacher who talked to them about history and got them really fired up and then said, what are you going to do? That was one starting point. Then age 18 to I'm not sure what, okay. So there's a kind of a big space. And the coincidence of being 16, So they would go around and stand around, and they're just kids playing and maybe pretending to flirt with those girls or whatever and listening to the German soldiers, what they're saying, etc. Like they could be undercover because they were kids. So they just felt not important but necessary, and then what's going to happen? It could be that hope of how, maybe Georges hopes it's going to be France, rules Europe or something. And sometimes our idea of what we think we're doing and what we're actually doing can be a gap. So Georges was risking his life for the good of many, thinking he's doing it for France, whatever that is. What is that? I think it's because of like falling through the gap that fear is not dominant anymore. There's fear, but it's not dominant anymore. And then action can happen from the direct experience. So from the direct experience, I'm 16, there's German soldiers talking, I've got a ball. Da, 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 da. And then by being necessary and being used, doing, more and more energy, the mind working better and better, the communication working better and better, feeling, so they would, there's more and more examples of someone would realize something and then they'd meet and they'd both realize the same thing. Something really specific, not like, oh, we're in trouble or a specific piece of information came clear by reading between the, as he said, the words and the silences. Oh. Whatever. The Russians have gotten to Warsaw or something.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
And you spoke about the two kinds of hopes, about the good and bad meditation. If we change the names of freedom and bondage.
Freedom and bondage?
Does it change the quality of the hope? The quality of the inner movement?
The quality of the?
The inner movement.
Inner movement.
In the practice.
Okay. I think what usually happens is good equals pleasant, bad equals unpleasant, without our catching it. So if we can be really clean about that, that freedom is what I respond to. What's needed is freedom and what freedom feels like. And bondage, I can just have a natural spiritual instinct that feels bondage and then knows what it's necessary to respond in some way when I notice bondage, which is another word for assumption, maybe better word. Assumption sounds kind of so theoretical and light, and it is a bondage. So then the response is coming from, I think, a really different place. So I might be afraid, but when I respond to freedom, partly I can work with any ingredient, including fear. It's not the fear working with me. I can work with any ingredient, including fear, but I don't have to pick up fear every time. Fear or no fear, action, not action. And in a kind of harmony with other people also responding to freedom. Does that answer your question or not quite? Or does that continue rather your line of questioning? I think we have assumptions of what freedom would be like. And then does my experience match that or not, that measurement? Whereas where there's interest in freedom, there's not interest in measurement so much.
I think what I meant that when you spoke about the two kinds of hopes, it gave a sense that that it's very difficult in a way to know the direction.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's also slippery and you can't catch it.
Mm-hmm.
The sense of simple freedom, not mentally, but freedom.
Yeah.
It's naturally due to the sense of direction.
Yep.
In the practice.
Yeah. And the slipperiness allows the direction to come with that immediacy. And it can be decisive, it can be patient, it can be clear, it can have options open, it can have so many things. But I think that the slipperiness and not knowing exactly goes with that, a different kind of simple, clear, not thinking about it first, not because of my plan, just yet. So talking about it, then it can feel as if it's heady and complicated. And exactly the slipperiness and the non-plan and the non-heady with the simple, just so direct experience, direct response, that kind of dialogue where it's all, we listen and then we just find ourselves doing. That's a good example metaphor of freedom. I think we'd like it to be simple because I know what's going to happen, because I can picture it first. And it's simple because there's no plan and it can just emerge. And we're with it rather than that gap of shall I or not? And so, of course, that means that sometimes we kind of fall on our face as part of that learning. Freedom to fall on our face. So many. I think in a way almost we could just check if when we notice friction and conflict, then what's the so-called, now we're using assumption so much that that will become trouble too. But if there's friction and conflict, what's the assumption? If there's block, what's the assumption? But assumption in that way that's not, it's a shape in the psyche. Rather than me believing something wrong. So just feeling the assumptions that come in, that feeling, oh, they all have it, I don't. The assumption is inaccessible to you, etc. The assumption, not good enough. Inaccessible. Alone. And then we can see how in each situation at some point our core drama acts itself out. There I am all alone with no resources. Everybody else has it all, or whatever. And so then it's kind of easy to know. It's like a nativity scene set up for us. Thank you for being here. May all be at peace. May our practice and lives be dedicated to what matters. Towards freedom for all.